Canadian investors are using ZSP over any other ETF for exposure to the S&P 500 index. Institutional investors, investment advisors, and DIY investors have all been trusting ZSP with their investment dollars since the fall of 2012. ETFs provide instant access to a portfolio of stocks to an investor in a single cost-efficient trade. For an investor to own the entire index would require institutional-level trading systems and expertise. To accomplish this, an investor would have to buy 500 stocks at a time, and then as the market moves, it would constantly have to rebalance those 500 stocks several times a year. ZSP simplifies this process by aiming to provide instant access to the 500 stocks in the index in a very easy and low-cost way.
Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that this information discussed today is not intended to be or construed as investment advice. Please consult a professional advisor before putting a loony in any of these financial markets.
The dirty secret is that no one's ever going to get paid back.
People have the shortest memories when it comes to investment.
We just got to get Keith into Bitcoin.
Hey, there's a bubble.
Welcome back to the Loony Hour, episode 132. As always, joined by the three amigos, Keith Dicker, Ice Cap Asset Management, Rich Diaz, PGM. What's going on? Gentlemen, where are you guys?
I am in the big city of Toronto. You know, you see the small town boy, you know, move to the big city. That's when it all happens, Rich. That's when it goes down.
Are you Bruce Springsteen now?
One of my first albums I bought, I think, was Born to Run, like in 1979 or something like that, when it came out. Yeah. But I am in Toronto in a hotel room, which looks somewhat similar to a room that Rich is in as well.
Right. Similar artwork.
Yeah. Anyway, so I came up for the weekend. You know, my son is finishing school. First year, he had a lot of success. So we're going to go help him get out of his dorm and, you know, shift him to another place for September. But, you know, I'm from the Atlantic Canada, Maritimes region. So I thought it'd be a great idea. Just put it out there and just get a bunch of people together, you know, for a pint or two, talk with the Loony Hour. So Rich is here as well. So in the Maritimes, in Halifax, you just say, yeah, everyone meet at the pub at six and you just take it over. That's the way we do things down there. No, not in Toronto. It's very formal. You need a reservation. You got to allocate so much to this and that. So, you know, it's a bit of a struggle. I experienced what Steve has experienced over the last couple of years putting events together.
Let's just call your event planning a shit show, to put it politely. But and this is why I do the event planning. So all the Loon Hour live events, this is why the boomer is not allowed to touch them.
The other funny thing was, I say to Rich, yeah, meet me here on Thursday, you know, at the hotel area. You know, Wednesday night, Rich, I get a text from Rich, I'm here at the hotel. I'm like, I'm not even there. So we got everything, you know, typical Loony Hour fashion, hey? But I think that listeners know that's the way we roll.
You're about as organized as the federal government.
I'm good. I have no stories. A little stress. I got lots of work to do, but I'm happy to be here and we're going to have a nice time tonight. And
you have no mic today.
I have no mic today. You know why? Because this freaking Shure company, Shure as shit, basically broke again. So I actually brought the mic, but the wire screwed up. I'm really quite bitter. And then I ran. That's why I'm schwitzing a little bit, because I ran across the street to get a wire in it.
So here's another good Rich story. Right, here's another good Rich. So Rich and I went out for a little walk around the block to get some fresh air. And we're walking. You know, Toronto's a big city, right? Like there's, you know, a couple thousand people out there walking around. And all of a sudden, this lady on the side starts waving at Rich. And Rich turns to me and said, I know her, but I don't remember her name. And I said, oh, I'll take care of this. So we ended up like crossing the street and he's like, I don't remember her name. What's her name? And, you know, I just simply go up and say, hey, I'm Boomer. What's your name? Right. And she goes, oh, I'm Rich's friend. Yeah. Mabel from Britain with a British accent.
That's a good one. Is that a past date?
No. Just a friend went to, there was a lot of McGill people out in London. So
not a big deal, eh?
Not a big deal. No big deal. Anyways, let's move on.
So we've got an episode here. We've got a special guest. It's going to be his second time on the show, Robert Asselin. He is the former economic advisor to JT, particularly, I think, when Bill Morneau was finance minister. So we're going to have his comments on the federal budget that was just released, highly anticipated federal budget this week. So we're going to get his comments on that from a guy, again, that's been inside the government, has been in that space. He now works for the Business Council of Canada. So I'll be really looking forward to getting some of his thoughts. We'll have him on for a little bit here. And then, of course, we'll dive into our usual market talk towards the end. So if you want to stick around and get Keith's updated thoughts on currency, bond market, everything that's going on in the world, we'll always get to that. But we felt it was important to have Robert back on the show. Again, an expert, I think, in the space that can really kind of unpack the budget and really pros, cons, and what it means for all of us Canadians here.
So I'm assuming things got a bit more expensive, really, for everyone in Canada if this budget gets passed, correct?
The budget will balance itself.
We care about fairness for the middle class. That is the most important thing. We don't care about productivity or debt burdens or incentives.
I think the best comment I heard a lot of them, of course, you know, one of them was, you know, something, I might get it a little bit wrong, but, you know, we want to make everyone middle class. That's not socialism 101. That's, you know, that's what you sign up for. That's the name of the course.
Everyone's special. Nobody's special is what I would say to that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to try to keep a positive spin. I think last year when we did the budget, I tried very hard to find three positive things that I found. And I've done sort of the similar thing this year, believe it or not. So just to try to keep it even a little bit even keel. But I'm looking forward to Robert. I think he's got a great CV and he really knows his stuff. And it'll be interesting to hear sort of his take, especially like you said, Steve, that he's a Liberal Party. He was a Liberal Party member. He was he's a wonk for many, many years. And he worked for a serious finance minister, which is Morneau, sadly lacking right now. But I don't know. That's all my view. I'm looking forward to talking to him and seeing him again. I think, is he our second double?
Second go around. Yeah, we've had a few of them now, but he's gracious enough with his time. So we'll see if Robert can come up with three good things that he found in the budget. So without further ado, let's cut to that interview right now. Robert, welcome back to the Looney Hour.
Thanks for having me.
The second time guest.
It's an honor.
We haven't had very many second time guests, so that shows how much we like you.
Well, you guys are stars, so I'm glad to be here.
Who do you like the best? Which Looney Hour host is your favorite?
You're all doing great, guys.
Me? I'm from Quebec. Come on.
That's fair. Robert, we've seen some of your commentary a little bit in the media. What was your initial gut reaction just when the budget was announced? You know, I think it was like highly, you know, there was a lot of debate about what was going to happen, what tax measures they were going to bring in on the revenue side. So I think there was definitely some surprise in there. What was your initial reaction?
My initial reaction was that it was a tax and spend budget at the wrong moment. It's never good to have a tax and spend budget, but at this moment, we have this like broad crisis in Canada, as you guys have, I think, said many times on this show. A GDP per capita is coming down structurally, kind of a low wage immigration model in Canada that has not been, pushing us forward. An economy that is too reliant on consumption, government expenditure, and I would say real estate in general. And so I just thought that I understand politically that these guys are a bit desperate, but I think it was the wrong cast, the wrong moment. I think as a consequence, we're going to get on the fiscal side in much more trouble going forward. And on the economic side, I don't think this budget has a vision for the future. Obviously, you cannot solve productivity in one budget, but I don't see a vision behind it and measures that will significantly improve the trajectory of where we're going. So overall, I would say a pretty bad budget for circumstances we're in. And it was very political, obviously, given the, where the government is in the polls. And so the question now is, will it help them? I have my doubts, but policy-wise, I don't think this is a good budget.
Did you feel it was inflationary? You know, is there enough there on the revenue side, you know, through higher taxation to sort of offset that? Or did you feel, you know, net-net, this is going to make the Bank of Canada's job more challenging?
Yes, I think there are two issues there. The first is that in the last weeks, provincial governments have added quite a bit of spending in aggregate. So if you add the federal part, overall, there's more spending probably that Mr. Macklem would like to see, even in the short term, although these budgets are over 5 years. Secondly, you guys are more the experts on this, but on housing, you would have seen a lot of demand stimulating measures in the last few weeks.
Yeah.
That again, will not help. Actually, that I would think this would be more of a worry, of an immediate worry for the Bank of Canada than the actual aggregate spending numbers. Because housing, as you know, is a big part of our inflation problem. They just boosted it even further by signaling that they are working as much on demand as on supply. And so if I were the bank, I think I'd be equally worried about that.
Yeah, one of the things I found interesting on the demand side, so yeah, they, for first-time home buyers, they pushed amortizations to 30 years. You can tap your RRSP now from 35,000, I believe, to 60,000. So there's definitely some demand stimulus there. One of the demand stimulus I kind of is interesting is they're obviously trying to ramp up like housing supply, which of course we need and is good. But I also wonder like how much of that is kind of counter-cyclical, which is like if you're trying to prevent housing starts from rolling over and ramping up construction, it is kind of inflationary.
Yes, I agree with that. And it's I think tough. it's very tricky for the governor because if he does move on a cut in June, it'll be hard after for him to get back to raising rates. And so once he moves, it signals that he starts cutting over time. And if housing on the demand side, things are eating up, and then there's a lot of things that we don't control that are very volatile right now, including energy prices. You would have seen oil prices gone up quite a bit today and yesterday. Those are kind of difficult to control. And so I think even in his last monetary policy report, he kind of said, or the bank said, you know, we kind of expect to stay around 3% over the next while. We're not convinced that in the short term we're making still the progress we'd like to see, although the trend is good. All this to me kind of shows that on fiscal policy, that's not the budget that was needed. But it's these guys cannot help themselves. They have this in their DNA. It's all they do. It's all they think about is how can we spend more? Low interest rates, high interest rates, low economic growth, high economic growth, doesn't matter. They're just going for it, you know, every time. And so that on that side, I'm kind of not surprised, you know.
Was anything different in your time, you know, working with that government and Mr. Morneau when he was finance minister? Yeah, I'm just kind of curious, like, what the, you know, behind the curtain conversations were like, you know, with a lot of this spending was floated around. Of course, you know, Morneau kind of got pushed out, but just kind of curious your thoughts on that.
Well, if you look at when the government got elected in 2015, the platform was well defined, the costing was, I think, reasonable. It was structurally on stuff that we thought would have a good impact on growth. Infrastructure was one of it. The child benefit also was a big measure. Of course, there were social measures, like for the Indigenous, for example, in which the party was very keen to get going on. And I think those are good things. But in general, it was kind of in check. And actually, if you go back, people don't remember this, but the second budget that Mr. Morneau tabled, there was no net new spending. You said no to a lot of things. Kind of stick to the platform. Again, implementation. We profile a bit of money going forward. I felt, to be honest, it was more when the pandemic hit, obviously, that things got off a bit on. It's almost like they decided to go for it. Not just obviously for good reasons that they had to do it for the pandemic, but after justifying all kinds of expenses that I think are questionable. You know, you look at freelance first budget, you're looking at 140 billion in new spending over 5 years. I think that was a big mistake when the economy was basically at par. The output gap was pretty much like where it should have been. And so we're kind of living the consequences of this today, I feel.
Who has like the biggest voice in that room when they're kind of like setting the budget? Like, I just wonder how many like arguments or discussions there are. Is it, you know, is it Freeland that really pushes this as the finance minister? Is it JT that says, hey, you know, I really want to get back in and I'm going to override you? Like, I'm just kind of curious, like what your opinion is on who's calling the shots.
Obviously, I'm not there. I cannot speculate. I have my own kind of gut feelings about what's going on. I know that when I was there, it was a lot of tension between the finance minister's office and the prime minister's office, which is not something that we should see as not being normal. I think a certain level of tension is important and necessary. It's kind of the job of the finance minister to say no, usually. In this case, with Minister Freeland, I sense that she's personally less in control of the budget process. It's more in the hands of the Prime Minister's office. And the PM himself, you know, his involvement in the process, I think, is a very high level one. There's certain things, obviously, he cares a lot about and will weigh in. But generally, certainly in the time I was there, would leave to others. Would not be personally involved too much, only obviously to weigh in at the end on things he disagreed and agreed with. But it's very different from a person to another. I know, you know, Paul Martin was obviously it was his own process. He was very specific on how he wanted things, and finance then was a bit more assertive, I would say. So, and I know Mr. Harper for the Conservative, who is also very involved for a prime minister in the budget process, would almost equally be involved as the finance minister. So they are not just one way of doing this. But in this case, I think it's clear to say that the PMO kind of political angle is more prevalent maybe than other models of doing a budget, you know.
So about Klaus Schwab, does he attend by Zoom video or conference call?
Their tinfoil hats.
Oh, my God.
I know Minister Freeland as him on the Rolodex, so I don't know.
Did you have a Google, didn't she? I mean, it's like, you just Google it. Anyway.
I have a more serious question for you. A couple different times then, Robert, you mentioned, you know, they were going to go for it. And it seems like they're always going for it, like all the time. And it seems like that's the culture, and it's never like they'll always use the phrase, you know, the, is it the fiscal anchor that they'll commonly
yes.
use? And,
yes.
you know, I don't even know what that means, truthfully, but it's, you know, they're going for it. You know, I like to use the expression or the phrase, you know, when you find yourself in a hole, you know, you find yourself in a hole, what should you stop doing?
Yes.
Anyone?
Stop digging. Stop
yes.
digging.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. You stop digging. And I do. It's just me. Maybe I'm wrong, but I get the impression, you know, the current government, they feel like they are in a hole. And, you know, obviously that's happened over the last 18 months, especially. But their solution is to let's just keep on digging. Let's keep spending and taxing. You know, I know it's easy to have a negative view on this stuff just because of where the cycle is going with the current government. But I know Rich likes to ask a positive question. Did you want to throw that one out now, Rich?
Well, no, I have some positive. I just have You know, we talked a lot about productivity growth, and we're going to get into the whole CapEx, sorry, the not the CapEx, the capital gains thing.
Yes.
One thing I've noticed is one thing that I feel was not necessarily addressed, either explicitly or implicitly, and I just want to make sure I haven't screwed this up, is sort of the collapse, really, is the only way I could describe it, in sort of the business or, let's say, private gross fixed capital formation, right? As part of the identity in your GDP function, you have yes. consumption, C, you've got government spending, G, you got I, which is your investment or CapEx, and then you've got net exports. And in Canada, we've seen just a collapse, really, in CapEx spending. And I was wondering if you saw anything in the budget that sort of addresses that. And if you think, and if you maybe if you could just venture some policy prescriptions on how we can arrest that, or have I sort of missed the move?
I think you raised a very important point on sectoral composition or industrial composition. We're very weak right now, essentially not strong enough in sectors where we produce and export things in the economy. You basically have a consumption-driven, government expenditure-driven, and real estate-driven economy. And also a scale issue, because if you compare ourselves with the US, we have about 3 times less large companies, or larger companies, I should say, per capita. That is a problem, right? Because by definition, SMEs will spend less on R&D, will spend less on capital in general, will obviously have a harder time getting scaled. If anything, this budget signals the opposite on solving this problem with the capital gains exclusion rate change, right? Because you're basically putting a tax on investment, a tax on success. You're basically saying your capital is less welcome here than it was yesterday, essentially. And I know people will say, oh, it's just, you know, the right thing to do, and this class war argument, which I'm not fond of. But certainly, if your objective is to provide confidence to investors, to people who have money, including companies, to invest in the Canadian economy, it's not certainly the single that came out of this budget. So unfortunately, I don't have anything very positive to say on that front. They did invest a bit on AI. Someone could say that's a positive kind of signal, but I still think it's very tentative. Look, Microsoft will spend about $100 billion in AI this year. I think the federal government is saying we're going to spend $2 billion. So obviously, I'm not saying we should spend $100 billion of public funds, but you cannot see the difference in the scale here, the ambition, you know?
Well, so, Steve, one more thing on sort of the CapEx thing. See, that's, I think, and maybe this is a philosophical question, but one of my beefs really is that it's an ongoing focus on consumption, government yes. consuming, yes. rather than government investing. And see, that's, people are very critical. I am very critical of the U.S. spending 6% of GDP when unemployment rate is 3%.
Yes.
But what they're doing is spending hundreds, if not trillions yes. of dollars on infrastructure, roads, buildings, fucking Mars rovers, whatever it is. And to me, that is where I think this government continually misses the mark, which is that's why deficits are not sort of all created equal. But sorry, that's my little two cents.
No, but it's such an important observation. In my opinion, it's a big part of the problem. David Dodge has been on and on about this, and he's right. Not every dollar that you spend is equal in that regard. You know, if you're going to spend in public R&D, which they did to their credit in this budget, it's not the same as sending checks to every senior in Canada before an election. You know, it doesn't have the same effect. And so in the US, what I like about what they're doing is a lot of it is science, technology driven. They are trying to kind of figure out the next generation of technology that will make our economy more performant on the carbon side, on the low carbon kind of side of the ledger. And that's how you kind of create the condition for growth. They have all these institutions like DARPA, ARPA-E, ARPA-H that drives innovation. There's nothing on innovation in this budget, or very little, other than the R&D funding. But R&D funding in itself is not innovation. And so you're absolutely right that they're not thinking that through, in my opinion. And it's been consistent over the last few budgets.
So, Robert, I just want to get on to the... the capital gains side, your former colleague there, Mr. Morneau, was quoted in Bloomberg the other day saying that he wasn't a huge fan of the budget. In particular, he actively resisted increasing the capital gains inclusion rate back when he was the finance minister. Was that correct? And I guess, yes. how aggressively was that lobbied when you were there as well?
So it was floated by some people inside government, and Mr. Morneau was always very consistent, very firm, that it's not even something he would contemplate. And frankly, there was no pushback after he kind of put that position out inside government, at least in the moment that I was there, the 2 years that I was there when the government was elected. After, I can't speak to it, but certainly he was consistent for as long as he was finance minister, because this was not introduced under him. Again, I did think it was a bazooka option for them. Basically, they're digging this big hole on a structural deficit. They needed revenue.
Stop digging, Robert. Stop digging.
there are not many tax measures that can give you $5 billion a year. Short of raising the GST or raising taxes across the board, which would have been disastrous, obviously, for them. They went for cap gains for that reason. And also because politically, I think they are, again, a bit desperate to start a class war, to give a sense that the rich are not paying their fair share. And on that, I just want to be clear. I think it's really important. We need more capital in our economy, not less. And it doesn't matter where it comes from. A dollar that is not invested in Canada is a dollar we're losing that eventually will make a difference on people's wages, on people's living standards. And that's how we need to think. We have to stop trying to penalize success in this country. And I felt on that, it was almost like it was an NDP government talking. I was very disappointed, to be honest, hearing the Prime Minister the day after the budget say the rich need to pay more, blah, blah, blah. I think that's BS, to be honest, and very damaging to the confidence of businesses and people to invest in the Canadian economy.
Not just that's the main, I'll just finish up, but I think that is the main point, Robert, that you hit on here exactly. As we've been talking quite a bit, where it's the productivity story, or you need capital investment to grow, a dollar spent is not the same as a dollar invested, and so forth. But raising, basically the amount of money that's going to be taxed at the capital gains rate, it tells, risk takers in yes. our country, saying, hey, you're not going to get rewarded for taking the risk. And instead is telling me that the public sector, who is not taking the risk, they get rewarded, for not taking yes. the risk. And at the same time, you have foreign investment. We desperately need foreign investment to come in here. And I would hope, that's never a great strategy, of course, but from your experience and what you know in your network, is that discussed before they say, yeah, let's slap that down in the document and run with it? Does anyone say, wait a second, this is not an investment in the country? If anything, this is going to, make it worse longer term? Or are they merely thinking, 12 months out, basically, I would imagine?
I am absolutely certain the finance department told them not to do this many times in so many ways, because they understand. They are trained economists. They are smart. They understand the effect it would have had. But politically, the problem is people in this government, who are in this government, including ministers and, advisors in these offices, they don't think like the four of us. They don't think about businesses. They don't think about growing an economy. They think about expanding the role of government. They think about spending. They all have their pet projects that they want to do, which is great when the economy is at 4% of real GDP growth and, when your deficit is under control. Those are great things to do. I love social programs. I think they are very, very important. And I'm one that continues to believe it is really important to redistribute wealth. But first, you have to create it. And the first part of the ledger for them is just not there. They're just not in the PM's DNA. It's not in the finance minister's DNA. And that's really unfortunate. And I think Canadians are catching up to it, frankly. I think on the business side, you know, there are a lot of people trying to tell them they shouldn't do these things, but obviously they're not listening. The only good positive thing I'm willing to say is there were things that were floated that could have been even worse, including a surtax on big corporations, including some sort of a wealth tax, which you could argue a cap gain inclusion rate change is somewhat a bit of a wealth tax. But so I think, you know, from a business side, we kind of dodge those kind of worst scenarios, but I still think this is pretty bad.
So I know Steve wants to go, but I just have technical points. We talked about how they wanted to raise money. Well, I did the crazy thing and looked at the actual budget. I'm sure you did too, Robo. But on page 21, you actually see on table one, that's easy enough. You have economic and fiscal developments, policy action measures. And halfway down the page, you have total, you can see how much money is raised. And the irony, of course, in all of this is that the money that they supposedly plan to raise drops off by 90% within 2 years. Which I thought was fascinating. So, you know, in this year's budget, it's meant to raise $6.5 billion. Next year, it's going to be $3 billion. And the year after that, it's going to be $0.3 billion. So I find maybe forecasts are, you know, like, you know, you take them with a grain of salt. But I just thought it was ironic that not only are they scaring away people who might otherwise want to invest in this country, their own measures tell you that they're not even going to raise that much money via this taxation measure. So I find it...
Yes.
That either it's a mistake or just kind of hypocritical. Yes. I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, Robert, sorry to interrupt. Robert, I was curious to segue on that as well. Yeah, how much of that is intentional? Because is it not unusual for the government to say, hey, guys, you got until June 25th or whatever to start selling all your stuff? Like, what's the rationale for that? Normally, it's implemented right away, is it not?
Yes, I thought it was very weird, to be honest, to give 2 months. And that's why you have this 6.5, because they expect people will realize their gains before the measure takes into effect, but it's only in 2 months. And I think 6.5 is very high, obviously. There's a risk there on the deficit side that, you know, if they only materialize half of that six, then there are, to put an uncertainty on their deficit figure going forward, on their fiscal anchor that you like a lot. I don't know. I think $5 billion a year in general seems like a lot to me on capital gains inclusion rate change. I'm sure finance modeled this the best they could, but it could be seen as a bit of fudging there, in my opinion. The other thing that people need to understand about this budget is they did a lot of what to meet their fiscal anchors or targets, whatever you want to call them. They did a lot of what we call reprofiling, which means they took money committed from last budgets and they pushed this out in future years so that the fiscal hit is not as high per year that we're seeing in the forecast than normally would have been the case. So let's say that last year they gave $1 billion to the Canadian Foundation for Innovation. If they took 500 million of that and they reprofile it in the year like 27, 28, 28, 29, then the bottom line looks much better, right, for this current year. And I think it did a lot of that. And so on that, the question then becomes, are you really implementing what you told us you would do? What about all these energy tax credit that you promised in response to the IRA? How come they're still not showing in the fiscal framework? And so it becomes a bit of a shell game. And that's why I don't take these deficit figures too seriously, to be honest. I think structurally, they've adding so much spending in the last budgets that just a bit of a blip in the revenues and they're in big trouble, you know?
I think was also hoping, you know, you could expand on, you know, I know the government kind of framed it up as, again, this class war that you mentioned. You know, they're saying, oh, you know, don't worry about the capital gains inclusion. That just is only going to hit, right, you know, 0.13% of Canadians, you know, the richest of the rich. And to me, that just feels completely incorrect. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but I mean, I have some real life scenarios I'd like to kind of walk through with you, but I just curious your initial thoughts.
Yes, I'm looking forward for people to kind of dig into this and show us the number, because just the number of Canadians who have second home, either a cottage or as an investment, another home they bought, seems much higher than that percentage. Then you have all the SMEs of a certain scale. You know, of course, there are exemptions, yearly exemption and lifetime exemption. But, you know, the lifetime exemption, even if it goes over time to 3 million, you're not talking about a lot of money for people over time who have accumulated some wealth, you know. So I would agree with your premise that I think it's a much higher number than that. But of course, it's politically convenient to tell us, for them to tell us that it's only like the super rich and the people who have who live in these mansions and have a lot of stocks invested that will pay this. I think in general, it will hit the upper middle class. The other thing that I find interesting, for me, it's a big gamble, I'll be honest, guys. And one of the reasons why it wasn't done before is I think it's a bit of an implicit attack on the boomers generation. Basically taking money from them to give them to, or giving the impression they're giving more to the millennials. And I've lost track of how we characterize every generation, the Z generation, I suppose. But, you know, boomers vote. And so I thought it was a bit very audacious on their part to gamble that, you know, boomers would not see that as a frontal attack on them kind of thing, you know.
Well, Robert,
you know what they say. How do you know when a finance minister is lying?
When they open their mouth.
Yeah, their lips are moving. Their lips are moving.
Well, Robert, one of the things that I found, you know, interesting is that, you know, you talked about, you know, someone selling their cottage and, you know, being then hit by the increased capital gains. Which, you know, you hear a lot of the rebuttal, well, yeah, you know, too bad, you know, you bought a cottage 20 years ago and it went up $1 million, like, you can afford it, buddy, pay it. But one of the interesting scenarios I've, you know, can think about and, you know, have clients and things of that nature is, you know, for someone like a family doctor, you know, so for example, a lot of family doctors here in BC are incorporated. They are basically deemed essentially entrepreneurs where they don't have, you know, a pension when they retire. So they incorporate, right, and they get billed accordingly. And then, you know, obviously part of going that route or that measure is then, you know, investing through your corporation. And under the new measures, you know, you don't even get that $250,000 inclusion in the capital gains. So basically, you know, if you're a medical doctor, you can say, hey, you know, I'm going to start I'm working hard. I've got some money saved up in my operating company. I now want to invest in some stocks with Ice Cap Management, and I want to build a portfolio through my holding company. Well, you're now going to be, you know, taxed at this highest marginal capital gains inclusion rate.
Yes.
And that, yeah, to me is like, I don't know. I wouldn't consider, you know, family doctors, at least in Vancouver, a lot of the ones I talk to are struggling to gather down payments for housing unless they get help from parents. So like, these aren't really, you know, a young family doctor is not a rich person.
Mm-hmm. What I don't like about the single essence is, I think you guys said it, but it's kind of a signal, we don't want you to be too successful in Canada. And I think it sends a terrible message. We want people to be successful. There are a lot of business owners that have started with nothing, that even immigrated to this country and, you know, with their labor, with their hard work, with their ideas, with their entrepreneurial spirit, they built something that was not easy. And so, you know, if we tell them, in general, you know, we're envious and we want to take more from you, I think it sends a very bad message. So it's not just for people who, as a result of this measure, will kind of have to pay more. It's for people who are thinking about investing. What you know, what would they do as a single? And it's just not just also this measure in isolation. I think if you look at the last budgets, you know, a dividend tax on banks, a DST, a lot of increases in taxes in general that make the climate investment, I think, more difficult in Canada. And so our banks or our energy companies can invest in other countries if they want to. They don't need to invest in Canada, you know?
Well, the other thing I was going to ask you about is, you know, the media keeps saying, you know, again, 0.13% of Canadians are impacted, you know, but publicly traded companies that earn capital gains, they just had their rates go up too, right? So anyone holding Canadian stocks, you could argue is actually being impacted by this as well.
Yes. And our stock market in Canada has been underperforming vis-a-vis the U.S. stock market. I think it's kind
of... Well, even against X, that's unfair, I would say, but even against ex-U.S., it's been very bad.
Yeah. The other thing you have to look right now, I think I'm getting a bit worried about it, and this is not the fault of this government, we're being honest, but our currency is taking quite a hit, you know? And at one point, does that become a problem?
Yes.
Under 70 cents, I start being a bit nervous. And you know what happens if Macklin moves in June? He cuts, the Federal Reserve doesn't, and signal that they're not ready to do so. I think our currency will take a further hit. And then what? You know, then at one point does it become a problem? You know, so from an outside perspective, I also think we have to worry about our economic competitiveness. And why people perceive Canada, you know. Obviously, we're not a poor country, but are we becoming a poorer country? I think that's an open question.
Can I ask him? Oh, sorry.
Well, we just had the Carolyn Rogers, Rich, your girl there. She, you know, she says productivity emergency. You know, we're now raising capital gains inclusion rates on these corporations. It's funny, you see this Bloomberg article come across my screen. It says Canada's finance minister has tapped former central bank governor Stephen Poulos to examine ways to entice its pension funds to invest more in the country.
That was my question. So I'm going to jump in there. I mean, that's what I find like infuriating. On the one hand, you are explicit in your efforts to curb one of the most value or creative industries in our country, which is the energy sector, which without nothing would be possible. It's 4% of 4.5% of our GDP in net income. And then on the other hand, they want all the pension funds to be investing in an economy that they're actively working to screw up, let's say, or not necessarily even screw up, but just make, they're just making it more difficult for those companies to earn. Can you sort of explain the rationale? Like how do these meetings, like let's get away from the stupidity of this policy, which we all agree. How do these meetings go on? Like you're in Ottawa. You're like, hey, somebody comes up with an idea, said, you know what we're going to do? Can I ask? Sorry, I know we're going off piste a little bit. I'm really curious.
Yeah, very unique to internal dynamics. But unfortunately, not having business, people with business background or economics background inside the government at the political level, I mean, obviously they are officials. There are plenty of it that have expertise there. But on the political side, that's where I think it's a problem, is that when these discussions occur, the kind of pragmatic, centrist kind of view doesn't prevail. And that's why you need, you know, people like Paul Martin and John Manley and Bill Morneau to be at the table and say, guys, I'm going to stop here because this doesn't make sense at all. Let's move to another item on the agenda, you know?
Or just anyone who knows how to use the internet, maybe, or a Bloomberg machine. I mean, really, it's absolutely kind of crazy, right? So
the other dynamic that is really important, it's very detrimental, and this is not just with the current government. You have this in the Ford government, you have this in the BC government, you have this everywhere, and you have this under the Harper government, is the constant preoccupation with short-term electoral politics. Winning the day, winning the media cycle. What are the polls telling us? Let's bring our pollster to tell us what Canadians want. Oh, they want to tax the rich. Let's do that. It's going to give us a lot of points in the polls. Let's go for it. You know,
it's very popular in BC.
Yes, and that's how it works. You know, you bring these pollsters with, you know, these slides. And guys, there's one measure people really like out there. Guess what? It's taxing the rich. If we do that, we're going to win the election. We're going to win back popular favor. But of course, this is idiocy. This is, you know, not well thought out. And then the damage you cause are permanent, are structural. So unfortunately, too much short-term political stuff, strategize over, you know, how can we win a few points here, as opposed to what's good for the country in the long term, you know?
So that's just one thing. Sorry, let me just jump in. So one thing that I find fascinating is, like, let's be honest. I think the probability that this current government will be there in 2 years, I don't think has moved much over the last 2 weeks, despite their best efforts. I could be wrong. And so what makes that particular tax adjustment so dangerous is that you could totally see the next government on day one being like, oh, we're going to reverse that. But the problem is you haven't collected. So what do people do as self-interested actors? They'll just say, you know what, before I sell this business or sell this country house or sell whatever, I'll just wait 18 months to make sure it's really going to go through, because I'm going to get screwed anyways. I might as well wait.
Yeah.
And then therefore they've spent the money, they haven't collected the money, and the deficit that would have been X is now X plus. And so that's why risk. I find it, is that wrong to think about it that way, or?
No, it's a real risk. I think given, and this is across the board, I would say, if you are an energy company right now, I think a lot of people are thinking that way, that they'll, you know, given the uncertainty about the oil and gas cap production, for example, about all this regulatory framework they've added on top of carbon pricing, about all this uncertainty about carbon pricing, which I think, by the way, is still the best policy out there because it is market driven. But the fact they've layered so many other things on top of it, I think makes it so unreliably predictable that a lot of people might unfortunately think, why don't we wait a few years? And what does that do to our competitiveness in that sector and our transition to a low carbon economy? Same with housing in a certain way, you know, you look at where interest rates are and where they're going. Maybe that's the most important impediment, whatever the government are saying they're trying to do in the short term, people will just say, well, we'll wait for the rates to come down, you know? So this is where government, I think, does a lot of overreaching and thinks that somehow from a budget perspective or from a kind of Ottawa knows best perspective, they'll solve all these problems. And obviously, it's much more complicated than that. You know?
Just on the chime in on the housing thing that you mentioned, it's interesting because they brought in, I give them credit. Like, I actually think a lot of the measures recently on housing they brought in have actually been pretty good policy. I mean, they waited way too long, of course, but it's funny to see the capital gains thing, I actually think is counterproductive.
Yes, I agree.
To what they're trying to do, because they need investment dollars in housing to get it built, right? So for example, if I like unpack this a bit further, if I'm a private developer, I need to pre-sell my building to investors in order to get construction financing. So you normally have to sell 60% at least of your building to get a shovel in the ground. Now, if you're going to the investors, the government, you're saying, well, listen, if you invest in this, whether through your corporation or as an individual, we're going to tax the shit out of you.
Right.
And so it's actually counterintuitive. And, you know, these guys come out here and they say, well, you know, we're going to build 3.9 million homes by 2031, which, you know, the number is ridiculous. Yeah. They won't even hit 2 million. I mean, the record number of housing completions is 274,000 in any single year. So anyways, I just, you know, not to ramble on, I found that interesting because, like I said, they brought in, I think, a lot of good measures on the housing front in the last 12 months. But this completely overrides a lot of what they just tried to do.
I echo your sentiment on housing. I think, and I like this minister. I think he's good. Some of these measures are probably very positive down the road. But again, there are structural obstacles, one of which is labor shortages. We have at the Business Council a few of the big construction players in this country, and they're all telling us that it's not a matter of money, of resources. It's a money of finding the workers for the amazing supplies that is coming, the pipeline of supply that is coming in front of them. And secondly, a good friend of mine is a mayor in Quebec, and she was telling me that on the zoning side, she's 100% dependent on the provincial government. You know, of course, there are conditions in these funds that the federal government have put forward. But at the end of the day, if they open like a a process to change the zoning, it could take, she was explaining to me, 4 or 5 years before the building starts getting built, you know, because people can contest it. There are all kinds of assessments. People can kind of drag this on for a while. And the process is designed that way by the provinces. And so it's one thing to say, you know, we're going to build 3.9 million houses. But, you know, on the ground, it's kind of a different reality. So on that, we can't be against the virtue of trying to get faster. But I just think that it's not as rosy as they may think again, you know.
So one final observation that I had with the budget that came out, and it's a positive comment in that they're able to do something that's never been done before. They've been able to suspend the economic cycle. No recessions are ever going to occur again. They're forecasting the Bank of Canada to cut overnight rates by, I think, 225 or 250 basis points.
When does it say? I don't remember.
By 25, I think it is.
Not happening.
If you look at the charts. And, of course, every single debt metric improves. Inflation is completely under control and all of these items. Yes. So that's a very positive development once that occurs.
Yeah, just on these metrics they use on to say that we have no problem and everything is great. We're the best on the G7 when it comes to debt net and all this stuff. You look at the fiscal framework, and next year, everything that is collected, every dollar collected for the GST will go to debt interest payments. It's the exact same amount, $54 billion. So think about that. That's a lot of money just to pay interest on debt servicing. And on the revenues we affect to debt servicing, again, just to pay the interest payments on our debt, you're over 10% of our revenues federally, which means that you only get 90 cents on every dollar to spend on anything else. And as that number, the 10% number gets higher, I just think we're going to be more and more restrained. The fundamental problem I have also with how they think about public finances is they haven't pivoted from a low interest rate environment to a higher interest rate environment. And that has huge consequences of how we should think about public expenditure, public expenses. And you never hear them just acknowledge that we live in a higher rate environment. And so the amounts that we're putting on debt servicing will just continue to climb much more than I think they are forecasting. And I do think, again, living in a federation, provincial governments do that too. At one point, this is going to be a bigger problem than people think, you know.
Yeah, Robert, we want to be respectful of your time. We appreciate you coming on. Keith, Rich, I don't know if you have any sort of final questions for Robert here, but I don't want to hold him too long.
I think the last comment you made was perfect. And, you know, really the risk here is that we do experience a recession, or we experience a period where the rates are not lower. So, we all of a sudden we go from 10, 12% of tax revenues to 18, 20, 25 very right. quickly, because you can have your interest burden shooting up the same time your tax revenues are just collapsing. Yes. So this is a slippery slope, guys. It really is. The probability of it turning into be a very bad experience. And in our view, sort of similar to what you mentioned before, this will get reflected in the Canadian dollar, like 100%.
Yes.
And yeah, it's looking to be a pretty good bet. You need a perfect outcome.
Yes.
For it not to happen with the Canadian dollar.
I also want just maybe to end our conversation. They always say we invest in Canadians. We make the choice in investing in Canadians. But if these investments would have been conducive to more productivity, to make our economy more resilient, I would have said, well, maybe part of it is right, but everything I've seen from the past spending has not made a significant difference, a dent into this productivity problem. So at one point, you can continue to say, we continue to spend because we believe things need to be fixed, but you actually need to assess whether this spending they're doing is achieving what they are saying. And unfortunately, with this government, I think it's so spread out, it's so unfocused that you have very, very little outcomes for the global amount they are spending. And that's also unfortunate. I'd rather have them saying, we're going to do two big things, spend on these two big things, and show people results, as opposed to trying to solve everything, but never really solving anything, you know?
Can you imagine if they led with, we're going to invest in foreign investors? But that's what we need. I mean, that's what the country needs. Anyway, Steve,
Robert, like I said, we kept you longer than we had promised, but like, this is such a great conversation. Honestly, really value your insights, your perspective. It's a breath of fresh air, and we thank you so much for coming on.
It was so fun, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a great conversation with Robert there. One of the things I was going to ask him, but I didn't want the podcast ramble on. We asked him post recording here, you know, how much of a say a guy like Jagmeet Singh has, you know, that's obviously in this coalition. And, Robert basically just said that he has a very strong say. And obviously, you know, we've heard it before from different guests here, but it's almost like the NDP is kind of actually running a lot of the policy in this country. So it's illuminating to sort of get his perspective on like what actually happens behind closed doors and how these budgets get set and these negotiations happen. It's fascinating.
You know, what's really interesting, and, you know, I come up with really great ideas and, you know, Rich rolls his eyes and everything, but, you know, again, it's about the whole perspective of the public sector versus the private sector. You know, I think what Robert he would agree. Yeah. You know, the private sector, you're the bad guys. You have to pay for all the spending that the public sector is doing. But if you want to penalize private investment, private sector investment, which is what's happening, you know, maybe there should be, are you ready? Let's cut the payroll in Ottawa. It's either job losses, you know, reduce that spending if you want to, because that's not an investment. Is not an investment in the private sector. You know, I'm looking up, like, most MPs are 200,000 plus now as of April.
Really?
Yeah.
I should run then.
Your minister, well, we know Steve is going to run for the Liberals coming up. You know,
mayor of Kitsilano.
Yeah, you got that happening. But, you know, again, it's just a really odd story that they're telling private investors, you know, people that are taking risk with their own money, and then what they're telling the world as well.
Keep in mind the tax changes they've brought in since they've been in power on corporations and entrepreneurs, right? Is, you know, they removed income splitting several years back. They just removed capital gains strips, which is like another sort of tax advantage that a lot of these would have. And now obviously the increased capital gains. So they're, yeah, I mean, they are penalizing entrepreneurs, business owners, which is interesting because, like I said, you know, productivity, Carolyn Rogers, you know, break the glass, productivity. And it's like, it doesn't seem like it's that hard to figure out.
The issue
is never enough, but it's never enough.
Well, fine.
No matter what you do.
That's one side of it. But the other side of it is, I think, hear me out. I think things like the carbon tax or dividend splitting or all this mumbo jumbo about raising taxes, I think on some level, I think Canadians would be much more amenable to those raises in taxes if we thought we were getting something for the money. But and by every metric, that is not what's happening. Whether it's, you know, hospital wait times, whether it's productivity growth, whether it's innovation, whether it's big companies that are, you know, blossoming because of the innovation fund, whether it's home building, like education. By the way, in the notes, in that PDF, by the way, educational attainment is shrinking across the board, across age groups. So I think on some level, if people thought they were getting something for the money, there would be a lot less of us. Maybe Keith would still be squawking, but certainly I would be a lot less, you know, outraged, really. But we're not. And so it tells you sort of what I think Keith's point is, that there's a lot of Pace is in the trough, and that's really my big takeaway for that.
I think you know, just get out of the way, government. If you're listening, just get out of the way. Like it's not fair to say that, of course, but you know, they're continuing to add Band-Aid on top of Band-Aid and everything else, and jointment and gels. They try to keep fixing this challenge and problem we have. Like I said before, have you ever looked at the Income Tax Act? Like physically looked at this monstrosity. It's like Bible thin paper, size 4 font. And my God, if you were starting a country and economy from scratch, you would not say, yeah, this is what we need to go with. Everyone would agree with that. So then by default definition, you know, let's just chuck that on the floor and, you know, come up with a whole new plan. But the plan involves a whole lot of less spending. Because spending more to fix a spending and debt problem, that's not the solution.
And, you know, interesting, Rich, you brought up the Microsoft as a company, and we were talking about Canada investing in AI, which was good. It's funny, I was listening to the Bloomberg Odd Lots podcast the other day, and they had the, what does he do? He was like the chief energy guy for Microsoft, and you're like, well, Microsoft has a chief energy guy. Like,
of course, consume an incredible amount of energy. Yeah,
and he was just saying, he was basically talking it through the lens of AI, and it was crazy. He said, I can't remember what city it was in the U.S.
Virginia. It's Virginia. Data. It's data. Something Alley.
Data centers in Virginia.
Data Center Alley.
So he said, 2 or 3 years ago, the utility company put out a forecast about how much they felt, you know, utility growth would increase their grid. And they had it increasing over the next 10 years. It was going to increase by like single digits, like virtually like no growth. And then the boom in AI has happened and the immense power that consumes. And this energy utility company put out a new report like 6 months ago being like, we're going to 10X and we're going to 10X in the next like 5 years. It was something like crazy like that. And now they're like, well, how do we do this? And so, Rich, they're obviously going back to natural gas plants to do that. So.
So just a one little tiny fact, an NVIDIA H100 GPU will consume more power than some countries. Each GPU consumes 700 watts of power. 3.5 million are expected to be sold in the coming year. So fascinatingly, for like basically the last 20 years, I know we have to go, but the last 20 years, energy consumption in America has been basically flat. They've grown, most rich countries, their energy consumption is flat. That what you said, the AI stuff, this new data center stuff, all this stuff, has for the first time boosted the energy consumption. And how are companies going to do this? Who knows? But it's really fascinating.
Was like, is it Amazon that was like, that's buying up warehouses near nuclear reactors?
Yep.
So there we go. I wonder if Canadian oil and gas is going anywhere anytime soon.
Solar.
I think that's, well, I mean, just, you know, we're getting close to wrapping it up here. We had Canada's CPI this week. I think headline inflation 2.9%, core seemed to soften, Rich. I don't know if you had any additional comments there. Feels like the door is still open for TIFF this June, maybe. I know the Fed was coming out and was quite hawkish this week, so I still think the Canadian dollar is going to be sacrificed at the altar, but I'm curious if you guys had any comments on that to wrap it up.
Well, I mean, everything right now, that this trend that started 2-3 weeks ago, you know, across all markets, it is continuing here. So, you know,
US 10 years ripping, Keith.
Yeah, we're doing well. We're making good money now with this trend. And, you know, people don't like to hear it, but, you know, if the Canadian dollar gets really weak, it's not our fault or your fault, but you might as well make money on it. And so, I mean, it is something that we're definitely positioned for, you know, first weakening Canadian dollar, weakening bond market. And like, if you look at the bond market recently, it's as we said, like, it's been muddled. It's been, and that's without a recession with credit spreads happening. Anyway, guys, it's a good story. I kind of got to get going. I really got to get going.
I know we have to go. I have two words. Not cutting. They're not cutting in June. They can't. We'll talk about that more that
we'll,
next
week. We'll debate that on next week's episode. But as always, guys, we appreciate your support. Hopefully you found some insights valuable there. We try to stay a little bit out of the politics, but we feel like we keep getting kind of dragged further and further down that rabbit hole, unfortunately. But as always, appreciate the support, and we'll see you next week.